So our next speaker is a person that has really distinguished himself and his company in the support of the One Mind campaign. Hussein Imanji, Global Therapeutic Area Head of Neuroscience at Johnson & Johnson, has been very instrumental in much of the progress that we've made. His lecture is entitled, Serious Neuropsychiatric Diseases Can Be Tackled Through an Innovative, Accelerated, and Collaborative Effort. I think you know that part of our goal here is to change a process as much as it is the research itself. His colleague, Magali Haas, is here with him, and not in the room is Paul Stoffels, who's head of research for J&J, and each of them has made unique and very important contributions to our effort. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Hussein Imanji on this critical topic.
Thank you very much, Garen, for the kind introduction, and thank you, Garen, as well as Honorable Patrick Kennedy and others. When they first told me about this initiative and asked if I'd participate, I really was delighted to, because I really think we in this room have an opportunity to make a real difference. You know, you've heard about the challenges, they're monumental, and yet the science is there. If we can galvanize people like we have with other challenges, I really think we can make a difference, and so it's delighted to be part of this. I thought I had to quote Steve Hyman's favorite scientific journal, the New York Times, and you heard from Steve about the devastation, the disability of the serious neuropsychiatric diseases. At the other end of the age spectrum are the neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, and this is, a New York Times editorial from a former Supreme Court Justice, Nobel laureate, et cetera, which really took the approach that, all the time we're spending worrying about our budget deficit, the healthcare crisis, et cetera, if you could just do something significant about this, you'd really have a major impact in terms of the finances. Because this is, we know, is a devastating illness that, every individual with Alzheimer's disease ultimately needs full-time care. With our aging population, we think the numbers of individuals with Alzheimer's disease are going to treble by the year 2050. So this is one of the things we're dealing with. I really do think we're dealing with some of the most devastating illnesses afflicting humanity. And I think this, so to speak, is a no-brainer. A society's greatest resource is our cognitive and mental capital. It's not oil, it's not minerals, it's our brain power. And if we could do something about these diseases, the learning disabilities or autism at the early end of the spectrum, the serious psychiatric illnesses that sometimes impair someone's ability to reach their full potential, or at the other end of the spectrum, things like Alzheimer's disease, things like age-related cognitive decline, if we could do something about those, we would help individuals, families, and society immensely. Again, this thing goes without saying. We live in amongst the most extraordinary times in terms of science and technology. This slide depicts what some people have estimated are the number of discoveries that have been made over time. And the estimate is that between 1550 and 1800, we made something like 250 big discoveries. In the next 200 years, we've made 1,250, and it's growing exponentially. And everything we know about us today in terms of society has been influenced by science and technology. Things like electricity, transportation, computers, antibiotics, vaccines, things that we take for granted has been advanced by science and technology. So investing here should be something we're doing. We heard earlier, briefly, and we're going to hear much more for the next two full days, we're making spectacular progress in our understanding at the basic and clinical neurosciences. And obviously the hope is that these advances will lead to benefit for these devastating diseases. For, other illnesses, this has happened. So if you look on the left-hand side, this refers to cancer. For the first time in recorded history, the number of deaths from cancer in the U.S. is decreasing. Almost all of it because of scientific progress, certainly some of it through lifestyle changes, et cetera, but most of it through scientific progress. On the right-hand side, what might be even more impressive is cardiovascular disease, where we've had more than a 50% reduction in mortality. What that red line going across depicts would be the number of deaths we would have expected from cardiovascular diseases if we hadn't made progress. And you can see how dramatically that's gone down with scientific progress. And for those legislatures, of course, Patrick Kennedy not being one of them, who, sort of pay attention to the economics, not, sort of the the moral and, you know, health benefits. From an economic standpoint, it seems like investing in medical, biomedical research is very useful. So this slide shows some of the analysis that suggests that there's almost a sevenfold return on investment for every dollar you spend on developing a new medication. Yes, a new medication costs, but if you look at the benefit in terms of reduced hospitalizations and other things, it really is works in your favor that you should invest in this because you'll get the benefit. And that quote at the bottom, that the medical revolution over the last century appears to qualify from an economic point of view as one of the greatest benefits to mankind. So we should be able to convince people to make these investments because there's so much to be gained. Health benefits there, society benefits, economically we benefit. And so can we just stand back and hope for the best and let the forces work? And the answer appears to be clearly no. And this is one of the reasons. What you're seeing here is sort of the dismal state of affairs currently in terms of coming up with new medications. So the bars, so the purplish bars, shows you the number of new medications that have been approved each year. And what you can see, you know, it really hasn't been a very good picture and it's going in the wrong direction. And what you see in the sort of blue line going up is the overall U.S. pharmaceutical company research and development cost. It's been going up almost exponentially now at about $50 billion a year. And you're seeing we're not generating new medications from that. And so today it's estimated that for each new medication that makes it to the market, given all the failures, et cetera, it costs something like $1.8 billion. And that's really not sustainable. So if we, you know, think that this is non-sustainable, well, why should neuroscience suffer? You know, let's get out of infectious diseases or something. Well, neuroscience is suffering because it's perceived as being the riskiest, and it probably is. So, you know, when Steve alluded to the fact that many companies are getting out of CNS, or at least more accurately in psychiatry, why is that? You know, we have this huge unmet need and, you know, millions of patients. So there's theoretically a market there. So why are they shying away? The first thing is, you know, in the last 2 years, the bottom fell out of the economy. And so everyone, you know, saw that, the economic downturn. And so companies had to decide where to invest. Things are so expensive, you know, $1.8 billion per medication, et cetera, you've got to decide where to invest. Neurosciences has been a victim of this. So there's a real recognition there is nothing more complex than the brain. And with the tremendous complexity, the question, you know, has been asked, where are the new targets going to come from? It's not like oncology where we know these pathways, or as Steve alluded to, you can do a biopsy and see what's going on. Ours is still somewhat of a black box. Where are the new targets going to come from? There's been a concern about generics, and what's the concern about the generics? Well, if you look at that table there, that's one of the tables, and I think it's either 2008 or 2009 data, looking at the biggest classes of medication in terms of how much we spend as a society. And three out of the top five classes of medications are neuropsychiatric medications, and they're all going generic. So the concern has been, if you invest $1.8 billion, how are you going to recoup this when everything's going to be generic? And then the next big problem we need to tackle, and especially I'd say for the clinical neuroscientists and the translational neuroscientists in this audience, is that medication development for any indication is challenging. And certainly with the brain complex, it's even more challenging. One of the big problems we face in neuroscience is that often, excuse me, we don't fail until late in the process. So because of our animal models, because of our translational science, because of our biomarkers not being quite as good as we need to, until you get into individuals with Alzheimer's disease and do the several-year study that costs hundreds of millions of dollars to see whether you're slowing down progression or trying to treat prodromal schizophrenia, et cetera, until you get that stage, you won't know for sure. And so you have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in order to find out whether the drug works or not. In other fields of medicine, it's sometimes easier to pull out your failures earlier. And so for all those reasons, that's why many companies are getting out of it. You know, I wouldn't be standing here if I wasn't supremely optimistic that despite these being very challenging, the most difficult thing we've ever done, I think these are all addressable. The tremendous complexity, yes it is, but we're making tremendous headway. The generics, think about it, you're freeing up money from the medical sort of payers' budgets that could go to more innovative treatments. Now, clearly it's not as simple as build it and they will come, but there's money being liberated from the system that could go to better treatments. this late-stage attrition we can address with biomarkers and a lot of translational models, et cetera. So I think we need to really think that it's not insurmountable, but it's bad. And, you know, sticking to the moonshot analogy, Houston, we have a problem. And I think we're going to have solutions. But this is really, I think, something that's fantastic that Garen and Patrick and others have done to mobilize people, because I think we recognize that business as usual is not going to work. This is the most difficult thing we've ever taken on. Sending a man to the moon and back is pales in comparison. I think what we're recognizing, as we talked about already, that the NIH, certainly companies are pulling back resources. That's leading to a diminished pipeline. As companies see the diminished pipeline, they get out of it. So you could see this downward spiral. As you heard already from Steve, and hopefully this symposium will be the beginning of a new way of doing things. Today, our expertise tends to be somewhat scattered. Things are fragmented, and a lot of our progress is unfortunately siloed. At times, the incentives for doing things together either aren't there or they're misaligned. And so, you know, everyone has to publish their own paper. Every company has to keep things secret because they need to get a competitive advantage and so on. We've got to change that. And I think we've got to take it upon ourselves, everyone in this room, to change that, and I think we can. And at the bottom, we're talking about stigma. And to me, you know, other than the real travesty, the pain and suffering stigma causes to our loved ones, to families, etc., it impedes everything. So it impedes science. When people don't think these are real diseases, we don't get our share of investment for, you know, the toll that these diseases take on society. We have challenges in, you know, parity for, you know, reimbursement. Patrick and others have done a great job, but it's still a challenge for our patients. And then even from a scientific standpoint, we want the best and the brightest working on these diseases. And sometimes when there's not a recognition that these diseases are as real as some other diseases, you're going to get your oncology paper on the in science. Are you going to get a PTSD paper? Well, it's going to have to be monumental. So stigma really has these wide-reaching impacts, and all of us have to take it on together to do something about it. Here's an example of what can be done, and I think it's a great example. So HIV and AIDS, we first heard about it in 1981. You know, that's a newspaper headline there. If you look on the right-hand side, you're looking at the number of deaths from HIV/AIDS in the U.S. You can see that this curve was going off the scale. And then something happened. And the something that happened was a sort of war on AIDS. Advocacy groups got involved. They were not going to take no for an answer. They mobilized. They got legislatures together. They got the NIH and others to put the money together. They got companies to work together. And look what's happened, you know. And when HIV and AIDS first came onto the scene, it was a guaranteed death sentence. You would be dead in 2 or 3 years. Today, at least in the Western world, you're going to have a normal lifespan, maybe short, something like 2 years. That is a staggering amount of progress in a short amount of time. And I know all the neuroscientists in the room are thinking, come on, an infectious disease, you know, we're dealing with neuroscience. And of course, it's a different order of magnitude in terms of complexity, et cetera. But we have some examples of what can happen in neuroscience. And I think ADNI, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, is one of those great examples. So it's been largely focused about identifying biomarkers that would map the trajectory of Alzheimer's disease, that would identify people with mild cognitive impairment or prodromal Alzheimer's, who's headed to Alzheimer's, when, et cetera. And basically, it's taken things from a very fragmented, incomplete, unsynchronized, and closed approach to biomarkers where everyone did their own thing to what we have on the right-hand side, where things are standardized, synchronous, multimodal, longitudinal, and open. And I think the open is another big part of it, where the other advantage is that it uses what's known as crowdsourced data analysis. So the data is posted there. Everyone can go and analyze it. And there's a notion that you have the wisdom of the crowd. You know, we all have our own biases and ways of trying to look at data. This makes it open. And as a result of all this, we've learned much more about biomarkers, whether it's imaging, spinal fluid, or blood, learning more about early markers that may predict who's going to get Alzheimer's disease, more about trajectories of illness. So there's a long way to go. But this is a suggestion of what we can accomplish in our complex diseases as well. Thank you. So how are we going to go forward? And I think as you heard from Steve and Garen, and you'll hear from Patrick and others, this has been all been happening in a relatively short time frame. So certainly not everything's ironed out. We don't have a lot of details we're going to engage everyone in trying to work out. These are some of the big principles. So we really need to develop this open collaboration platform for the neurosciences. A lot of the things on this slide recapitulates what Steve said, and I think it's the way we have to do things. So we need to generate and share data, develop these portals that will allow global coherent databases to be accessed and interrogated. What Steve said about generating sharing tools, sometimes, I'm sure when you hear from Carl Deisseroth about optogenetics, what fantastic tools are becoming available. So yes, the scientific problems are critical, but the tools that allow us to get there are equally important, and we've got to do that together. We've got to generate and share models. That's where a lot of our illnesses, unfortunately, fall down. We haven't been able to come up with the models, and in some cases, many companies, many government agencies, maybe many academics are trying to work on the same things themselves. Why not try and do together, validate them, standardize them, and then use them together? Those are all the things we need to do. And the bottom bullet there in red, it's about creating insights. The more we can learn about these diseases in a more holistic way, the more we can do something about it. So the thought would be that this is, where health sciences is today. And, it's got these, parable of the blind man and the elephant, everyone feeling a different part of it and, coming up with a different notion. But having, sat through the session that Mickey Goldberg shared earlier, I think we're going to have to change that analogy to something, other than blindness. But, the idea is that medicine today has been built on hundreds of years of individual observations. And yes, given the complexity, we need to go deep into every one of these layers. But is there a way to coordinate it so that the sum is greater than the holds are greater than the sum of the parts and all that? That's what we're trying to do with this endeavor. This is an idea that we think is going to be very important to create these disease knowledge networks. And on the left-hand side, Steve touched about much of our challenges. We clearly recognize that many of our diseases have these major genetic influence that somehow we've got to make sense of at a cellular level, at a circuit and systems level, ultimately to our symptom levels and then the syndromes, et cetera. Somehow we need to traverse those aspects of the illness. And on the right-hand side, we don't live in vacuums. What the brain does for a living is adapt to the environment. We have to factor in the environmental influences, whether we're talking about medications or stressors or other things. And to again reiterate what Steve said, it's not about this Orwellian notion that thou shalt study this in this, coordinated, synchronized manner. It's about allowing the individual work to get done, but get done in a way that can also be coordinated so that we can interrogate the data in a more meaningful way rather than the siloed way we've traditionally done things. There's starting to be platforms and tools available to do this, and this Transmart shown here is just one example. And there's all kinds of development going on. We're delighted at this symposium. We have colleagues from General Electric, IBM, Google, and others who are doing so much work in this space that will allow us to generate the data, synthesize it, interrogate it, and refine our hypotheses. That's what we need to start to be thinking about doing much more than we have been in the past. This is what we need. We need to create an organization, and believe me, having spent 15 years at the NIH, I'm not one for building big organizations with enough bureaucracy. But we do need some of these processes. So I think one of the first bullets at the top there is we do need an independent, trusted third party. We're living in the time of conflict of interest and concerns about who's doing what to whom and why and all those things. So we need to come up with some sort of structure that really has the desires of everyone in this room, that can put this together, can manage it, can oversee it in a way that puts advances research in a meaningful way. We want to have the Department of Defense, the NIH, the pharmaceuticals industry. I think what's shown there, I really think at times biomedical research, with some notable exceptions, has maybe not taken advantage of things like the informatics and the computing and the physics and the engineering. Let's bring all those people in and the advances that they have made and have those bear upon our problems. The second thing is, you know, clearly one of the sort of catalysts for doing this is the economic. You know, we need to share costs and risk and reward. But I strongly believe that while those economic factors are the catalysts to doing this, really the benefits are going to be much more the economics. We are going to be so much further ahead by working together, even if it's the finances that have brought us together, than we ever would be by working alone. Are there examples? And I think, again, this is one area where the biomedical community has perhaps lagged behind others. And some people in other fields use the term pro-competitive rather than pre-competitive, because what they found is that actually by working together, you actually advance all your individual efforts. And what's shown there are two examples from basically the, you know, sort of semiconductor field, where Semitech and IMEC are examples, where the semiconductor industry has really been able to galvanize people to work together to recognize a lot of these problems are shared problems. Let's advance them together. Then we can all go in our own separate directions and develop our own drug or patent our own thing or do our own thing. But there's so much we can learn together. And we're delighted we have some of the colleagues from IMEC here today to give us some of their insights on how did they make it work. And it may not all fit for neuroscience research, but I think there are learnings we can take advantage of. So I think really what I want to let people know is I strongly believe that the time is now. We're facing an emergency. The crisis with our patients, with our soldiers and others is real. But I really think, like Steve mentioned, if it was just a crisis, if we really didn't have the means and the ability to do something about it, that'd be one thing. We in this room have the means and the ability to do things. There is really a coalescing of a number of forces. The economics of healthcare reform is driving change. We simply cannot sustain what we're doing today. We have to change. The data is catching up to our research needs. So we really are, you know, getting there in order to be able to generate and interrogate the data. The technology is catching up to our data needs. So we think we're on the verge of these exascale computing capabilities that would have, capabilities that are maybe 1,000 times more powerful than the present fastest computers. Consumer forces are driving things. So let's take advantage of all these things and make a difference. And I think we have to. Really, these are diseases that touch all of us in one way or another. You've heard it already how devastating these are. And to me, you know, this is a mantra I'm sort of espousing to every CEO I speak, et cetera. There is no health without mental health, and we can do this together. Thanks very much, and I'll just end on this slide. So clearly, this is something that's already been a collaboration with many different people putting in their, you know, very dedicated work. This is the hope, is that this is just the kickoff. We're just launching this. We're going to pick everyone's brain. We're going to dissect all the plans, etc. But I think if we work together, we can make a real difference. Thank you. Okay.